Black Friday, well, shop Wayfair now. Month-long big deals, yeah, these are steals.
70% less money spent.
You can't go wrong, check out the song. Best if they're poor, Black Friday scores.
Garlands and trees,
saving with ease.
Lights for your house, lamps for your spouse.
Save at Wayfair.
On dining chairs, mattresses too. Sheeps, that are you. Everything home, these things in chrome. Hands of the clock, area roads. Fast shipping, wow, Wayfair is how.
Win the season, win the season.
Wayfair, 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 Wayfair.
I'm Janet Ellis, and this is Twice Upon a Time, where each week I invite a guest to come and chat with me about their favourite childhood book. They often bring along their own battered copy. This is a podcast to celebrate that magical book which cast a spell over us and often still has us in its thrall. Now, before you hear my conversation with this episode's guest, I did just want to take the time to give a quick recap of her many achievements, because that's hard to do when you're face-to-face with someone who hates that sort of thing. Arguably one of Britain's most brilliant living artists, Maggie Hambling first came to prominence as artist-in-residence at the National Gallery in 1980, and has since continued to be a major force on the British art scene, known for her wonderfully evocative sea paintings as much as for her public works, including the giant scallop on Aldborough Beach and other sculptures commemorating Oscar Wilde and Mary Wollstonecraft. No stranger to controversy around her projects, but more of that later, Maggie's also known for her frank point of view and her quick wit. That's much in evidence throughout our conversation. It'll come as no surprise then that quick-witted, often brutally honest Maggie's choice of book is from the Just William series by Richmond Crompton. With the first title released in 1922, the books featured the exploits of unruly schoolboy William Brown, leader of the Outlaws gang, whose adventures in their typical British country village, often pitted against a rival gang led by Hubert Lane, also featured William's family, including his long-suffering sister and brother, and another famous adversary in the form of Violet Elizabeth Bott, whose equally famous epithet, "I'll scream and scream until I'm sick," became the catchphrase for spoilt children trying to get their way for years afterwards. But enough of Violet, and back to marvellous William, and to our wonderful chat with Just Maggie. I am sitting in the London studio of Maggie Hambling, painter, sculptor, and all-round brilliantly good egg. Maggie, which book have you chosen?
Well, it's very difficult. I mean, I have them all. I think William's Happy Days is one I would like to quote from.
The Just William stories.
Sorry, I should have said.
That's all right. I'm happy to prompt. That's my role. When did you first read them?
It was all to do with a great friend of mine called Jeremy Rodwell, who was very pretty and had a lot of curly hair, and he introduced me when I was about 8 or 9 to them. And then I just lapped them up.
Richmond Crompton was beyond prolific, and she wrote at least a book a year, which is extraordinary for someone who writes. I just think hats off, Richmond, because that's a lot. But she was always a bit hostage to fortune with William, wasn't she? Because she wrote about 40 books for adults, and I don't know about you, but I have never read one.
No, I've never read one either.
She described William as her little Frankenstein, who would keep coming back.
Well, I don't know that much about Richmond Crompton. I just think she's a genius for having invented William.
Yes.
Because he's so real.
Totally. And that world.
And that world.
It's a really small world, isn't it?
Well, the world of the village, yes, but it's very like where I grew up in Suffolk. You know, it was just like reading how to deal with the situation I found myself in when I was a child.
Did you have the same freedom to roam? Because it really struck me, reading the books again, how William just sets off in the morning and he's often not seen again till dusk.
Yes, yes, of course, we completely free of any of this modern health and safety nonsense. I remember when my mother asked our neighbour if our neighbour was taking her son Rex to the fair, which came to Hadley. And this mother of Rex said, "You're not taking Margaret, are you?" And so mother said, "Yes, of course, why not?" And so this mother said, "Well, she may touch something that somebody else has touched."
Oh, even dear. Then, even then.
Poor Rex, we had a fight every day to see who would be Robin Hood and who would be Maid Marian. And I'm afraid he was mostly Maid Marian, and he went on to be the Queen of the Ipswich School. And if one was Robin Hood, which one was, one had command of the apple tree at the end of the garden, and we could just be up the apple tree pelting things down on poor Maid Marian. So I identified completely with William, despite my parents getting me the Girl comic, which I only had for 3 weeks, and I immediately changed it to Eagle. And I was very proud of the fact that I thought I was the only girl in England who took Eagle comic and not the Girl. Anyway, never mind all that. I identified with William completely, and it wasn't until I was 9 that I had a dog, because, I mean, very much part of William is Jumble. And it wasn't until I was 9 that I finally got a dog, and so that completed the whole identification with William.
There are other parallels too, aren't there? He's got an older brother and sister. Isn't that the same for you?
Yes, absolutely. My sister was 11 years older than me, and my brother 9 years older than me, and they could be indeed Robert and Ethel, yes.
It's quite a fractious relationship with those two, isn't it? Reading them again as an adult, do you still fully identify with William?
Absolutely. I mean, the reason I took him on my Desert Island Discs is that he always finds a way, somehow, however impossible everything seems, he finds a way through it. And also the thing of being a gang leader, because obviously he's the leader of the Outlaws. And I was a gang leader at my first school. I was just William. You know, my mother would dress me in a Bo Peep costume, which I absolutely loathed. And I was just William.
How many were in your gang?
Well, I was sort of deputy leader of John Hitchcock's gang. There was Clive Davis's gang and John Hitchcock's gang. And there was a sort of valley, a lawn that was a valley at Hadley Hall School. And one gang would line up on the top of one side and one gang on the top of the other side. And somebody would say 1, 2, 3. And we'd just go for each other. Just go. And sort of try and kill each other. I always longed for John Hitchcock to be unwell, because I became the gang leader in his place.
So who was the Hubert Lane?
Oh, Clive Davis and his lot, obviously.
That was an instant answer.
Yes.
Yeah, I love the idea of gangs just being in terrible fights and yet still meeting up the next day and having another one. I think that's a pretty perfect
world. You know,
all this
seems to have rather disappeared from life.
It does, yes. And tell me about your household. Was it a bookish household?
No, not at all. There wasn't any art, really, and there weren't. I mean, there was Palgrave's Golden Treasury and Walter de la Mer, whom my mother loved, and that I learnt that poem slowly, silently, now the moon and all that. But, you know, words, extraordinary words came into William that you wouldn't normally expect in a so-called child's book. The word recalcitrant came up, describing a tap that didn't work too well. And so this word, I was obsessed with this word recalcitrant, and then eventually I looked it up.
Well, she didn't write them for children, did she? Richmal Crumpton herself said she wrote them for adults.
Yes.
Which I suppose is why children love them so much, because there's that element of definitely not being talked down to.
Exactly.
And definitely a glimpse into a world that you know you'll inhabit someday, but for the moment is blissfully out of reach.
That's quite right.
William can stay a child for as long as he likes.
And William really controlled the household, of course. I mean, William was in charge, which is also a rather attractive property of William. Yes, my mother always said I was the most obstinate child she'd ever met, and she was a teacher, so she'd met one or two children. But there we are.
How did it manifest when you were a child?
God knows, God knows.
Do you like the illustrations?
Well, there's a lot of what I call that hatching business. You know, there's lines. If they, in the life room, if they use those lines, I say it looks like the model's got fishnets on. Not allowed to use that. It's an outworn cliche of drawing those hatching lines. However, I have to put up with everything because Thomas Henry really does fit so beautifully with the stories. I just like to read this bit from page 171. There's the story is William the Superman, and it's in William's Happy Days. And I'm not as good as Martin Jarvis at doing this, I'll say that straight away. A friend of his mother's is talking about a bring and buy sale. Because you know getting anything out of people round here is like getting blood out of a stone. She paused for a long overdue breath, and William, looking at her fixedly, remarked, "There isn't blood inside a stone." "I know," said the visitor, "that's the point." "Why did you say there was then?" said William. "I didn't," said the visitor. "I said that getting anything out of people round here is like getting blood out of a stone." "But you can't get blood out of a stone," said William. "I know, that's what I meant." "Why did you say you could then?" "William," said his mother, "I think it's your tea time now." I mean, he's absolutely right.
He is right. Another thing that struck me is that he has, and it's demonstrated in that reading, breathtaking honesty.
Yeah.
He just, even when he's not telling the truth, he does it in a way that enables his own honesty. I mean, I wouldn't want to use it's his truth because that's a terrible phrase. But there is something about William that his world dictates his behaviour in a way that seems to him utterly, ruthlessly honest.
Exactly so.
Exactly. And you too.
I mean, the falsities of grown-ups are really brought out in these books. You know, the hypocrisy and all the rest of it. And the pretending is brought out by his very logical thinking.
William has an astonishing ability to be literal, which I think, I don't know, do all children have that? Do we grow out of it? Because it's such a wonderful quality, and I thought,
I think we all have it.
I'd like to get back to that.
Yeah.
I'd like to get, for example, Robert says about one of his girlfriends, "I love her, she's different." And William goes, "Well, why is she different? Is she blind or lame or something?"
Yeah.
I think, yeah, that's kind of the world I want to live in, where you just take each fact as a fact and examine it carefully. And if you find it wanting, you can say so. I think another thing that you have in common with William is that you both live entirely in the present. William is unbothered by his past. It's never really mentioned. And the future for him is a morass of adults behaving weirdly, because he often refers to the fact that when he's adult, he's going to be like him, but with more freedom. He will not have bedtime anymore. He will not have to eat foods he doesn't want to eat. He will never have to again put on an Eton collar.
Yes.
But at the moment, all the stories are rooted in this firm present.
Absolutely right. And I mean, you're quite right. I do try to live in the present, and there's nothing more present than when I'm working, because when the muse arrives, which occasionally she chooses to do, and the painting paints itself, that's an incredible feeling. And I'm not aware of what's happening then. It's just painting itself. I mean, I'm only aware of the miserable failures, which I destroy. And I live most of the time in a lot of doubt and gloom and depression. But occasionally, when something works, it's the most extraordinary feeling. It's better than anything, better than sex, better than anything. So, yes, I agree, in the present, in the present, in the present.
And he has a kind of residual kindness, doesn't he? He thinks, I mean, particularly in his dealings with his brother and sister, who kind of fall foul of it, but he often thinks he's helping them. In fact, he loves helping.
Yes, William's help, as we all know, is about the last thing on earth anyone would want. But he does. He has a sense of being a bit of a saint with some of Ethel's nonsense and some of Robert's austerity. And it drives them, of course, completely mental.
And Robert's ability to fall in love every single day with a girl who is absolutely the one is adorable, isn't it? And yes. Sometimes William catches that and thinks he could be really helpful.
Exactly.
There's a great story where one of Robert's latest inamoratas is coming to tea, and William is encouraged to stay strictly out of the way. And Robert, the brother, even goes into the kitchen to tell the cook what she must and mustn't produce for this young lady, who will stay in Robert's life, as we know, for about a day. But as she's coming up the path, she sees William hiding, and she's absolutely entranced by him and plays the game and makes herself half an hour late, by which time Robert is in conniptions because yes. He imagines that she has ditched him, and relationship is beyond fledgling. I mean, it does not exist. But William's heart was so in the right place that he loved this girl, and he thought she'd be totally perfect for his brother. And she has to play along with it. Yes. There's a lot of that. And there's another one which came to mind about when they're moving things from one room to another. I think they're getting the painters and decorators in. And the moving gang, and there are three of them, one of them is inebriated. And one of them says about the other, yes, he's lost the use of his legs. I think he lost them in the pub. Because they are very funny stories. And William sets about helping them moving things. And, of course, everything gets broken and walked over, and the dog is involved at one point. But it's this idea of helping, which is so beguiling to me, because his intentions are pure.
Absolutely. He's a bit of a boy saint, really, apart from being the absolute devil. And I suppose that's part of the attraction.
What do you think about the relationship to his family? I mean, we talk a bit about Robert and Ethel, his brother and sister, who are just, I mean, they are so exasperated by him. But his parents have, it's an interesting thing, and obviously reading the stories, as we both probably have, at a bit of a gallop, many, many of them, you can see that his father is constantly appalled by his son. I mean, constantly.
Yes.
But his mother excuses and forgives all the time.
Yeah, but then there are moments when the father, actually something terrible that William's done, is rather good for the father, and he calms down, gives
and,
him half
and
a crown.
And slips him half a crown, yes. Yes. In fact, yeah. In one of the early stories, there's William's been given a shilling by somebody, probably to get him out of the way, and he says, oh, he feels as rich as a Rothschild. And like you, I would have read that without in the slightest knowing what a Rothschild was.
Yes.
But having set it as the apogee of casual richness.
Yes.
Which is a beguiling thing for a child, too, to feel in charge. And he goes straight to the sweet shop, where the sweet shop owner is wont to put an extra sweet on the scales after the weighing is finished, which is a lovely thing in a shop owner.
Yes, it's the wonderful detail, the marvellous detail of that sweet shop, or of the old ladies doing the bazaars, or the wonderful ladies doing sort of health exercises in the garden. And, I mean, all these eccentric people, he makes them very real, completely real.
Totally, yeah. And his mother is darning one of Robert's socks, which has gone through on the heel, and he's about to meet yet another young lady. And his socks are blue, but she said, I've run out of blue wool, so I'll have to darn in mauve, but it won't be seen. And Robert goes, but it will, I'll know. I'll know it's the wrong colour.
Yeah.
And you're right, that the humour in the books is just...
Well, on every page.
Yes, absolutely.
On every. And when I had my heart attack in New York, very luckily, a couple of years ago, I kept requesting Joss William books, because Joss William got me through the whole damn thing. You know, luckily, I said it was in New York because the ambulance came straight away. If I'd been in Suffolk, of course, I'd be dead. But I then was in Mount Sinai for 6 weeks, and I kept getting through these Joss William books terribly fast. So more and more supplies had to be got. And it really, he really got me through the whole thing.
Well, she wrote over 300 stories. So.
Yes.
Yes. Do you listen to the Jess Williams stories?
Sometimes. I do think Martin Jarvis is a master at reading them. Yeah, they're so full of rich imagery. I read them far more often than I listen to them because somehow his world is my world and I can associate everything with something from my childhood.
And what about the television adaptations? Did you ever see any of those?
Yes, I saw one of them. But again, it's, you know, the book invents a world which I can identify with completely. And I don't need a sort of television film or even Martin Jarvis reading it to me. It's most magic when I actually read the words and come across something like Samson and Delilah or Recalcitrant or whatever it is that is so extraordinary.
I know what you mean about books where you have such an idea of that world in your head that to see it translated is somehow reductive, isn't it?
Yes, it's like somebody else is interfering with it. Somebody else is interfering with the world that Williams created for me or for you. Somebody else has come in and interrupted the whole thing.
And the world is so, in a book, so portable too. You can take it absolutely anywhere.
Yeah.
I'm glad it made it to New York. That's very comforting. I wonder what the Americans think of him. I don't know.
I don't know. I think it's a bit subtle, possibly, for Americans.
There's a row of dots after that. And when you were growing up in this household without books or art, when did you know you could do it? When did you know that you were good?
There was an art exam at school when I was 14, and I did nothing but throw paint at people and generally draw attention to myself because I was deeply in love with a biology mistress who was invigilating the exam. And then I saw the clock and it was 3:20, and I knew at 3:30 I'd got a hand in a painting, so I just did one. And when the results came out 2 or 3 weeks later, I was top of art, and that was a great shock. And I thought, well, it's worth looking into this business because apparently I'm good at it and I don't have to try. And then, of course, I stayed up until 2 o'clock in the morning trying to paint the night sky out of my bedroom window. And I took the paintings into school and they were all laid out and the other girls were just laughing at them. And the art teacher came in and I was standing in the corner on the point of tears. And I said, I was up till 2 o'clock in the morning doing these paintings and everybody's just laughing at them. So she said, it has to be water off a duck's back. Don't give a damn. Well, it didn't say don't give a damn. But you mustn't mind what anyone says about your work. You're your own best critic. And it has to be absolutely as nothing, what anybody... That was a wonderful thing to be told at the age of 14.
And it made sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
So could you feel... I mean, you talked about being in the studio and sometimes it works and sometimes... You would think it doesn't. But when did you feel that sort of power, even if it goes, that sort of instant power of somehow getting it right? Was it then, or did it come later?
I mean, everything I do has to be an experiment, otherwise it becomes laboured and mannered and dead. Everything has to be an experiment, and so one's sort of walking on tiptoes and occasionally making a great leap into the unknown all the time. So there's never an answer. And quite often I can work on something for 2 or 3 months and have to get rid of it because a painting comes alive and dies lots of times. And if it finally kicks the bucket, you know, it's got to go. But I could do that painting in a morning or in 20 minutes or something, but not unless I'd spent 2 or 3 months producing all this rubbish.
That's what I mean about honesty. That's what you have in common with William, a kind of self-knowledge that transcends actual analysis. I'm kind of sorry to make you do it, because I sense that you'd rather just do it than talk about it.
Yes, I mean, I agree with Matisse, who said all artists should have their tongues cut out for the amount of rot they talked about their work. Quite right.
Well, here we are. Glad you haven't, although I noticed that you have lost a finger, Maggie, which is a great loss, I think, because your hands are important. How's it feeling now?
Oh, it feels fine.
Yeah, good.
And the two funny things to happen were Dave, the plumber, walked into my studio in Suffolk when the right hand was in a great big bandage and I was working with my left hand. And he said, oh, are these going to be half price then? Which I thought was very good. And then I sent a photograph of my hand to my friend Carol. And she immediately texted back and said, oh, you'll have to go in for Prince Harry's Invictus Games. It's fine. But, like a lot of other people, it does feel as if it's still there and moving around a lot of the time, yes. Fantasy finger, it's called.
How extraordinary. And is it comfortable, that feeling?
Yes, I don't mind it at all.
You said you didn't know much about Richmond Crompton, why would you? She started writing as a kind of diversion for herself. She was a teacher and then contracted polio and lost the use of one leg and therefore couldn't teach anymore, and submitted short stories, one of which became William, and she carried on with that. She never married. She was sent to boarding school, which she found miserable, but she then lived with her mother until her mother's death. And like a lot of women of that generation, probably there weren't so many men around,
yeah,
on account of the war. And she had no... in all the interviews I've read with her, there was not a scintilla of self-pity about any of this, except the fact that she would like her other writing recognised. And obviously, because I was coming to talk to you, I thought there is, it's a clumsy parallel, but nevertheless, I persevere. with some of the art that you've produced, the public-facing art, that has attracted controversy, which was never intended to be a rebuttal of anything at all, but only a celebration.
Yeah.
And I thought with her work too, you know, she never intended William to be anything other than celebratory and yet wanted this other work acknowledged, and it was not. So I suppose my clumsy question is, you know, is there a way that art sometimes has to, any art has to sometimes confront people to have a future meaning, or is that just a distraction?
Well, you're quite right that I never set out to be controversial, and certain bits of my work, certain public sculptures, have caused a bit of fuss, yes, which has always been a surprise to me. I mean, Scallop on Albury Beach, I couldn't understand the fuss about that, because I thought it was one of the more beautiful things I managed to make. Then I got a double page spread of abuse from Brian Sewell for my Oscar Wilde sculpture. And I rang everyone up and said, have you seen the Standard? Have you seen? There's real street cred to be abused by Brian Sewell, who I came to like, actually, near the end of his life. Anyway, and then there was an exhibition of paintings of dogs, and Brian Sewell reproduced my painting and said, the only one who's any good at painting dogs is Maggie Hamling. I didn't telephone anyone that night. And then the latest one, the sculpture for Mary Wollstonecraft, my friend who died last year, Paul Bailey, said the best thing. Because he always watched the Channel 4 news, and at 8:02 that Tuesday evening, when it sort of hit the world, he rang me and said, well, you have put the pussy among the pigeons this time. And as I was leaving Waitrose in Saxmundham, one of the Suffolk ladies gave me a big grin and said, been making trouble again, I see. So I suppose it is all a bit just, William, isn't it?
It is absolutely that, yes. You were just trying to help.
Exactly.
The other thing I get struck by reading the books is the disgusting food that the outlaws produce for each other. They, for example, they just get a piece of licorice.
Oh, licorice water.
Licorice water. Pop it into a bottle and wait for it to slowly, not completely dissolve, but turn a kind of pale brown.
Exactly.
Which at one point, actually, when they kidnap the baby, well, they don't kidnap, they don't think they've kidnapped the baby. William is charged with looking after a baby for the afternoon, but he has to go and meet the outlaws, so he takes the baby with him, tethers the pram to a fence, holds the baby to his chest, runs to the barn where they're already burning a fire, uses licorice water on the baby's face to clean it before it turned to its mother. So it has lots of purposes. And they all pilfer things from their various houses. Yes. To contribute to their feast.
Like a bit of a pork pie and a lot of strawberry jam, which they don't eat together.
Yeah.
Which they share, yes.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. The baby also gets covered in paraffin oil, which is not recommended for childcare of any age, I think. In fact, there's a really interesting way she ends that story, Richmond Crompton, because the baby is returned. The pram, meanwhile, has been taken by a rival gang and used as a go-kart. So the pram and the baby are not in the best possible state. But as William is wheeling this baby back towards the mother, who thinks he's just taken it out for the afternoon, the baby's sex is never revealed, by the way, the mother just says, "Oh, thank you so much, William, for looking after it." And in capital letters at the end of this story, Richmond Crompton simply says, "That was before she saw the paraffin oil." And that's the end.
Yes.
That's the end of the story.
Yes.
Do you think that the stories survive because they're of a time that is special, or is the time immaterial when you read them? Does it not matter that it's between the wars or whatever?
The time, I think, is immaterial. I mean, when a child gets to a certain age, I give them the Martin Jarvis tapes, or I give them a book of Just William. And it's remarkable how they all take to it like a duck to water.
Because she actually wrote the stories over a span of a huge number of years and incorporated, they were started just after the First World War, but they went through the Second World War.
Yeah.
So she kind of grew with them, all the while maintaining. The only thing that changed, actually, is that when the stories start, William lives in a house with a cook and a housekeeper and various other bits of staff. By the end of it, without mentioning the transition at all, they're in a much humbler home, but they do still have a sort of housekeeper person in attendance, which obviously is necessary as the foil for some of William's worst outings. But it's a really subtle change. She doesn't, as with all of her writing, there's nothing.
Nothing's
clunky.
Ever laboured.
No, exactly.
You know, it is all just, it's like a wonderful breeze that just flows around, and there's nothing heavy about it. I suppose that's what makes one feel so optimistic.
It is, yeah. The girls in it don't come off terribly well.
Well, there's Joan.
Joan Clive, yeah. She's favourite.
And, of course, I'm sure we all know children like Violet Elizabeth Bott.
We certainly do, yes. And I have to say, in the television adaptations, I do think Bonnie Langford got that just right. Just right, that sort of... Because William is initially, with most of these girls, he's a little in awe of them, their perfection, even though he shuns it. He says about one child, "I really hate her because she's got shiny hair," disparagingly, because he never aspires to that. But he likes it when they like him. He can appreciate it. And she says about, you know, he falls in love with one of the teachers, and Richmond Crompton says, you know, he felt the dart of the little blind god. But he has a kind of admiration for these girls, despite the fact they could never be in his gang.
He likes the adoration, you know, because girls tend to adore William, and he maintains this nose in the air sort of... rather aloofness from them. And I think that's terrific.
You have that too?
Now and again, yes.
I couldn't have enjoyed this more. We could go on. Well, I could go on for hours, but I won't keep any more of your time. Because are you now itching to get back to work?
Well, I am rather, yes.
Okay.
Well, I've enjoyed it too. And I just recommend to everyone that they... go straight away and find any Just William book at all, and they'll be involved from the first paragraph. I don't think you ever get too old for Just William, because, you know, however depressed or whatever happens, you can just reach for a Just William book and everything is optimism again, you know, that life is worth living and life is extraordinary, and it just keeps one going.
I'd put that on the back cover if I could. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Twice Upon a Time with Janet Ellis. The producers were Claire Broughton and Diggory Waite, and the executive producer was Caroline Raphael. Twice Upon a Time is a Hattrick podcast.